VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The number of coronavirus-related deaths in the United States approaches 15,000, with more than 434,000 confirmed cases. Worldwide, the number of deaths is beyond 88,000, with 1.5 million confirmed cases. The Strategic National Stockpile is nearly out of N95 respirators, surgical masks, face shields, gowns, and other supplies desperately needed to protect frontline medical workers treating coronavirus patients. The House Oversight Committee has released documents showing that about 90% of all the personal protective equipment in the stockpile has been distributed to state and local governments. The remaining 10% is being held in reserve for federal workers. House Democrats say the Trump administration is leaving states to fend for themselves, competing with each other and federal agencies in a free-for-all bidding war that drives up prices. The U.S. Congress is rushing headlong into a conflict over the next coronavirus aid package, as the White House wants to pump $250 billion into a small business fund, but opposes Democrats' proposals to tack on billions for protective gear, food stamps, and support to state and local governments. An attempt for a Thursday vote in the Senate will pose a first test. Despite the urgency to act, it's a sudden breakdown over what all sides agree is the need for federal help as the pandemic crisis roars through communities large and small, and Washington prepares to go beyond the $2.2 trillion package approved just 2 weeks ago. Even as coronavirus deaths mount across Europe and New York, the U.S. and other countries are starting to contemplate an exit strategy and thinking about a staggered and carefully calibrated easing of restrictions designed to curb the scourge. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The Chinese city at the heart of the global pandemic, Wuhan, reopened Wednesday after 76 days in lockdown. Elsewhere, the economic, political, and psychological toll of fighting the new coronavirus grew increasingly clear and more difficult to bear. New York City endured one of its darkest days so far, with the virus death toll surging past the number killed on 9/11. It recorded 931 new coronavirus deaths, the biggest one-day jump yet for a statewide toll of nearly 5,500. As the coronavirus tightens its grip across the country, it is cutting a particularly devastating swath through an already vulnerable population. That's Black Americans. Leaders in cities hard hit by the pandemic have been sounding the alarm over what they see as a disturbing trend of the virus killing African Americans at a higher rate, along with a lack of overall information about the race of victims as the nation's death toll mounts. An Associated Press analysis found that 42% of the victims whose demographic data was shared by local officials were Black, even though African Americans account for roughly 21% of the population in the areas covered in the analysis. Among the cities where Black residents have been hardest hit are New York, Detroit, New Orleans, Chicago, and Milwaukee. The stage is set for November, barring unforeseen disaster. Joe Biden will represent the Democratic Party against U.S. President Donald Trump this fall. The former vice president's place on the general election ballot cemented Wednesday by Bernie Sanders' decision to end his campaign. Biden likely won't secure the number of delegates needed to clinch the nomination until June, but without any Democratic rivals left, a general election campaign that will almost certainly be the most expensive and one among the nastiest in U.S. history is now underway. The government is set to report another shocking level of unemployment claims Thursday, even as nearly 10 million people applied for benefits in the previous 2 weeks because of business shutdowns from the coronavirus. The number will likely keep increasing in part because many states are still clearing out backlogs of applications for unemployment aid, and with more companies running through their cash cushions as the virus-related shutdown persists, they're resorting to layoffs to save money. The Saudi-led coalition fighting the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen announced Wednesday that its forces would begin a ceasefire starting Thursday, a step that could pave the way for the first direct peace talks between the two sides that have been at war for more than 5 years. In a statement carried out by the Saudi Arabia official state news agency, a Saudi spokesman said the ceasefire would last for 2 weeks. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberian President George Weah declares a coronavirus state of emergency.
All Liberians and residents within the borders of Mosuwado County, Magibi County, Nima County, and Grand Cru are to stay at home for the next 14 days beginning on Friday, March 10, 2020.
Kenyan authorities face a backlash after extending mandatory coronavirus quarantine. Africa's biggest airlines vows to keep flying despite coronavirus losses. Zimbabwe's central bank orders corporations to deposit their U.S. dollars in domestic banks. And a special court grants provisional release to former Chadian President Hissène Habré.
The third reason that was contained in the letter released by the Ministry of Justice was that Hissène Habré was 78. He's sick, and that coronavirus specifically attack elder people and people with many other problems.
Ibrahima Khan is a Senegalese human rights activist, and Tanzania's government makes an about-face to allow pregnant girls to attend school. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The worsening coronavirus situation in Liberia has forced President George Weah to declare a three-week state of emergency in a bid to curtail the spread of the virus. In a nationwide address on Wednesday, the Liberian leader said the state of emergency will affect the country's 15 counties, restricting movement and limiting business activities. As Moses Gaziewu reports from Monrovia, the lockdown will begin this Friday.
As required by law, I, George Mane Weah, President of the Republic of Liberia, hereby declare a state of emergency to exist.
That was President Weah explaining his constitutional powers to declare or impose a state of emergency. But a state of emergency will have to be approved by the Liberian legislature in compliance with Article 88 of the Liberian Constitution. For this to happen, President Weah has called for the Liberian legislature to convene in an emergency sitting today, Thursday. The state of emergency restricts movements between Liberia's 15 counties as well as cross-border travels.
As a further measure under this state of emergency, all Liberians and residents within the borders of Mosuwado County, Magibi County, Nima County, and Grand Cru are to stay at home for the next 14 days beginning at 11:59 p.m. on Friday, March 10, 2020.
Mr. Weah said the nationwide lockdown will begin tomorrow Friday at midnight, with residents only allowed to leave their homes for essential reasons ranging from health and food.
All non-essential businesses and government offices will remain closed, with the exception of essential businesses, health facilities, and a few key government offices.
There were 31 confirmed cases of coronavirus in Liberia as of Wednesday, April 8. President Weah called on retired health workers to join their colleagues in fighting the rapidly growing caseload of the coronavirus in Liberia.
I would like to call on all retired health workers in Liberia to join hands with your counterparts to reinforce our capabilities and strength to fight the COVID-19 with your vast experience and expertise.
The Liberian leader declared the emergency without providing means for citizens to fend for themselves in an already challenging economy. Electricity is unstable, water seems to be inaccessible, and civil servants are yet to get their salaries for the month of March. Moses Gazeu, VOA News, Monrovia.
Kenyan authorities are facing a backlash this week after extending mandatory quarantine for people held in centers where coronavirus has been detected. Kenya currently has 172 confirmed cases and 6 deaths from the virus, and quarantined hundreds of arrivals since March to curb the pandemic. Rights groups say the government is treating those held in quarantine like prisoners, but health authorities say the tough measures are needed to prevent the virus from spreading unchecked. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan rights groups issued a call to government transparency on people held in coronavirus quarantine centers. A signed statement released Tuesday by 24 groups expressed concern after authorities extended the quarantine period by 2 weeks in centers with confirmed infections. Alan Maleche is the executive director at Kellen, a Kenyan group that advocates for health rights.
The civil society consortium is calling the government to action because the government has not been forthcoming with information to those who have been held in mandatory quarantine. The government has not been clear on who's paying for the cost. The government has not been clear on when people are supposed to be tested. So generally, we are concerned that information is not being availed to people who are held in quarantine.
Kenya has designated 57 quarantine centers in Nairobi and Mombasa, hosting hundreds of people at their own cost. Jaylene, who for privacy does not wish to use her real name, has been at a Nairobi quarantine facility for more than 2 weeks. While she has shown no symptoms, Jaylene says she will have to stay 2 more weeks because the center had a confirmed infection.
We haven't had even a single word about whether or not the further 14 days will be paid for by the government.
Some have complained also about the sanitation in Kenya's quarantine centers. John, not his real name, has also been in another Nairobi quarantine center for more than 2 weeks.
The conditions here are deplorable. In a floor, we are like 30 people sharing 3 toilets and 3 bathrooms. The toilets don't flush, so we have to use buckets. So if there's any place we can contact the disease, it's in these facilities.
John says that no one in his quarantine center has tested positive for the coronavirus. His claim could not be independently verified. Kenya's health ministry says it is aware of the inconvenience of quarantine, but maintains it is in the interest of protecting the public. Kenya's Director General of Health, Dr. Patrick Amoth, on Tuesday defended the extended quarantine period while speaking to the media in Nairobi. He said it was the government's responsibility to ensure anyone released was free of the virus.
We want to assure you again, especially those who are in quarantine, to ensure that you follow the social distancing rules, the infection prevention control measures, the hand washing. And very soon, we are going to again check on you after the 10th day to see if you are negative. Working together with the county governments, we shall be able to release you to go home and continue with self-quarantine.
The rights groups have urged greater transparency for the Kenyan government on its coronavirus quarantine centers. The statement noted it was not clear how many people are in mandatory quarantine in Kenya and how many of those have been tested for the virus. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Africa's biggest airline, Ethiopian Airlines, has lost more than $500 million since January this year because of the coronavirus pandemic. Despite the financial loss, the company's CEO remains confident that the airline can keep flying, in part by increasing its cargo business. Simon Marks reports from Addis Ababa.
Ethiopian Airlines CEO Tewolde Gebremariam told reporters on Tuesday the airline had lost $550 million between January and April as the coronavirus pandemic brought passenger traffic to a near-complete halt. He acknowledged the airline is in a serious financial crisis and also reported that 3 airline employees have tested positive for COVID-19. He said the 3 are in stable condition. But Tewolde expressed his belief that Ethiopian Airlines will ride out the current storm. He said the company was cushioning the financial blow by finding new streams of income.
We are now focusing on cargo. The cargo business is relatively doing well because urgently required medical supplies are needed all over the world. From east to west, west to east, north, south, and so on. We are also trying to convert some of our passenger aircraft to cargo.
He also said the company has saved money by cutting back deeply on daily flights and suspending talks with Boeing and Airbus to replace older aircraft in its fleet. Airline industry experts say some of Africa's air carriers are likely to go out of business during the ongoing crisis. John Grant, a senior analyst at the aviation data firm OAG, told VOA via a messaging app that Ethiopian Airlines was better positioned than any other African carrier.
Their management team have done a better job. They have a more diverse network. They're using modern aircraft. They've got a good hub in Addis that feeds Europe to South Africa, feeds West Africa to Asia and the Middle East, feeds South Africa up to the United States and other points. So it's of all of the African carriers, they are probably regarded and perceived as being the best in class.
Grant also lauded the company's move into the cargo market.
Cargo capacity at the moment is very, very scarce around the world. And by virtue of having some both dedicated cargo aircraft and swapping in some passenger aircraft and using them for cargo flights, that in the short term can generate some revenue. It's never going to generate as much revenue as the passenger flights. But, you know, it keeps the cash coming in. And at the moment, the rates for cargo are anything up to six times what they were 3-4 months ago, because there is this scarcity and this urgency to move items quickly.
Before the coronavirus pandemic, Ethiopian Airlines was Africa's busiest carrier, making more than 350 flights per day to more than 100 destinations. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 9th. Zimbabwe's central bank has ordered all corporations to deposit their U.S. dollar earnings into foreign currency accounts in domestic banks. Economic analysts say the order is likely to be met with defiance. Ade Gondo reports from Harare.
This past week, the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe ordered all corporations receiving foreign currency to deposit the money into their domestic nostril or foreign currency bank accounts. The move comes after the central bank ended its ban on the use of the dollar in domestic transactions to mitigate against the economic effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. Both moves come as the government experiences a severe liquidity crunch because normal sources of foreign exchange have dried up as trade has collapsed during the pandemic. Economist Gift Mgano at the Zimbabwe Ezekiel Guti University has reservations about the new statute because the central bank in the past has raided corporate accounts to fund government operations.
Don't forget that in 2008, the Reserve Bank took $2 billion from private sectors, NGOs, which were in the bank account. So the instrument now is coming because of realization that people have experienced and there are still fresh memories around the past atrocities by policymakers.
Mugano added that while the Reserve Bank can reduce those concerns by sticking to its pledge that it won't raid foreign currency accounts, the government is hard-pressed for cash.
Look at tobacco. This year, we have our tobacco, but we can't sell it because it is sold on auction. The auction is a public gathering, and it's against corona virus, social distancing principle. And at the same time, who are the biggest buyers of tobacco are the Chinese, where there's a lockdown. So you see that close to $1 billion we used to receive from the tobacco exports, we're not going to get it.
Ghana also says the government is under increasing pressure as revenue from both mining and tourism has all but vanished because of the pandemic. Zimbabwe's economy has nearly collapsed over the past few years with soaring inflation, shortages of most basic goods, and an inability to import essential goods such as fuel, food, and medicines. The spread of COVID-19 around the world makes the situation that much worse. The government has struggled to build confidence, but its order 10 months ago barring the use of foreign currencies in domestic transactions worsened the problems. The Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe introduced what is called the RTG currency to replace the old system of using foreign currencies such as the dollar and rand for nearly all transactions. And the government took to using treasury bills, short-term bonds to pay its own debts. Mugano says businesses supplying services and goods to government lost money last year because of the switch.
Look here, the corporate lost money on the debt, about $8 billion, which was converted to 1:1. Yet, at the inception of local currency, it was in US dollars. Let me look at Command Agriculture. It was funded by private sector, but the government was issuing treasury bills as a way of funding. It was now a debt taken by government. So they will say, we'll pay you and they were running them over. They didn't pay them on time. So there were 3 months, they had 3 months maturity, you see. They're keeping on rolling them over until it became a debt.
Analysts say the estimated US $2 billion circulating in the informal market is a sign of the deep mistrust of government initiatives to show up funds in the formal banking system. Mugano says the government has also used the law to coerce businesses to subscribe to funding programs for government. And he says the latest statute is part of a heavy-handed approach that raises concerns about the government's true intentions for depositors' foreign exchange. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo.
Senegalese authorities this week granted former Chadian President Issa Habré a 60-day release from jail. Habré has been serving a life sentence since a special African court found him guilty in 2016 for war crimes and crimes against humanity committed during his 8-year rule, 1982 to 1990. The special court also ordered Habré to pay $33,000 to each of the estimated 7,400 victims of his abuses. Human rights activist Ibrahima Khan has been following the case since 2000, when the Senegalese court first indicted Habré. He says the Senegalese attorney general, in his letter to the court, outlined three reasons for granting the provisional release, including overcrowded Senegalese prisons, Habré's old age, and the coronavirus, which seems to affect older people more.
I think the decision to release Issa Habré was taken on the basis of three elements. The first one, the prisons in Senegal are overcrowded, and that led to the decision of the President of the Republic during the celebration of our Independence Day to release half of the inmates. 2,098 inmates were released. Two, the situation created by the COVID-19 is that Since 3 weeks, Senegal decided to stop any visit in any prisons in Senegal. There was a fear that if the virus comes in through the prison, almost all the prisoners will die. The third reason that was contained in the letter released by the Ministry of Justice was that Issa Habré was 78. He's sick, and that coronavirus specifically attack elder people and people with many other problems.
The former Chadian president was sentenced to life for war crimes and crimes against humanity.
As I said earlier, coronavirus is among the reasons that the government used to release Issa Habré. I will come back to another one because a few months ago, there was rumor that Issa Habré was going to be released. Even the chairperson of the Committee Against Torture, based on those rumors, sent an official letter to the Senegalese authority warning them that Issa Habré by any means should not be released. He was released by the authorities using the Senegalese legislation. According to the Senegalese legislation and even the decision of the court that sentenced Issa Habré said specifically that Senegal will be using its own legislation to really hold Issa Habré within its prison. And that law has a number of provisions that allow the Senegalese government not only to release a person indefinitely, but also to send the person back home. And the Senegalese government so far in the letter said that Issa Habré was only sent back home for 2 months for the authorities to find a way of dealing with the coronavirus and the crowded prison that they have, and then they will make a decision about his future.
Do you think that the African Union approved the granting of the provisional release before it took place?
The government of Senegal is responsible for the safety of Issa Habré in prison. Two, the government of Senegal is confronted to a particular situation of crowded prison and has to make a decision. Even if some of the decisions are just interim decisions, they had to make those kind of decisions. And three, I believe that, you know, as any human being, Issa Habré also needs to be treated fairly, taking into consideration a number of situations.
The Tanzanian government declared this week that along with the $500 million that the World Bank released to fund the country's secondary education programs, pregnant girls will be allowed to attend school. The announcement signals a reversal from the presidential decree that had restricted pregnant girls from attending school even after they had given birth. Judy Gitao is a regional coordinator at Equality Now's Africa office. She tells Reiki Shryak that they are optimistic yet cautious that this announcement means education for girls and boys in Tanzania will be equal.
And so we've grabbed a hold of this and are happy for it, but are cautiously happy, because it's fantastic news. We've never had anything forthright with regards to the right of pregnant adolescent girls accessing education. But we are precautious because the implementation of that particular declaration needs to be done in line with human rights principles.
Was there aid that was withheld from the government of Tanzania because of their rule against pregnant girls going to school? And if so, what role did that play in this decision?
Well, when it became public, and it's been for a while now, I mean, over about 2.5 years now, when it became public that the World Bank would be funding education in Tanzania, civil society bodies across the globe, really, and including within Tanzania, agitated for those funds to be withheld until such a time that as Tanzania would be able to grant education to both boys and girls indiscriminately. And so a lot of noise on the back foot of that. And so when the monies were released earlier in the week. Initially, civil society bodies thought that they'd been completely let down until the statement. And so it would seem that the efforts and the agitation that's been taking place across the piece actually didn't fall on deaf ears. And so the response by the government is a clear indicator or a clear indication that perhaps the government did hear and did pay heed to some of the statements that were put out by civil society actors.
Are schools in Tanzania open right now? And if not, is there a concern that this decision will be put by the wayside when they are reopened?
So two things. Schools are not open. They're closed, of course, as a result of COVID-19. But then it is clear that once the statement is out, we as civil society organizations, as human rights organizations, intend to hold the government of Tanzania to account. One, to verbally reverse the different policies and measures that have been put in action, the ban. Different schools, public schools, have instructions to kick out girls who are pregnant. And so this statement needs to materialize in a reversal policy, actually calling for girls to come back to school. Secondly, of course, there's need for the government to put in place re-entry policies to allow girls back into the main system and not into a parallel system or any other, shall we say, night school or technical training schools or TVTs. And then thirdly, it's to completely address the vulnerabilities that resulted in girls getting pregnant in the first instance. Let's not forget, many of these girls are victims of sexual violence and no investigation or prosecution of perpetrators have taken place. Let's also not forget, many of them are victims of sexual exploitation and coercion. And then finally, also a need for the girls to understand sexual and reproductive health and rights.
Judy Gital is the regional coordinator at Equality Now's Africa office. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Nairobi. That's it for this Thursday, April 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.